Case for argument, Montanez v. Simon. Mr. Schiller.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, trial counsel. I actually want to begin by talking about something that isn't in the record, but it's in the public record. I looked this morning on PACER. It's now been almost a year and a half since we got the punitive damage award against Officer Fico, and he still hasn't been sued again, which I think is a fairly notable record given the fact that he was being sued on average 2.5 times between 2007 and the end of 2011. And obviously, we can't tell if there's causation between him getting this one-time punitive damage award after avoiding that 9 previous times. But we think that there's a reasonable inference. There's, I think, an issue as to the economics here that really needs to be clarified. The city's position is essentially that this fee award was a windfall, and they contend that by comparing the fee award to the amount of damages. But in the Section 1983 cases, our firm at least, in which those are a small portion of our cases, makes an economic determination based on how many hours our attorney is going to put in and are they going to be compensated for those hours. And under that determination, we put in way too many hours given the compensation. It wasn't a windfall. It becomes a lost leader almost at that point, given the amount of hours versus the amount of damages. And in that scenario, it's a complete red herring to compare it to the damages because we knew this was a low-damage case all along. The reason to take this case was not based on the damages, was based on our belief that there was clear liability, but that most firms would turn it away given the circumstances. Circumstances being, quite frankly, you had somebody with a long criminal history, who was on probation at the time, who was drunk, and who pled guilty to aggravated battery. There's very few firms who are going to believe this is a believable plaintiff and worthwhile taking. But his story, his presentation, and the physical facts made us convinced that was a worthwhile case, even though it was just a beat-up. That in connection with what looked to be an officer who was ramping up his brutality based on the public record in terms of his lawsuits gave us a reason to take the case. But we would have never taken the case if we thought the end result was, in total, we were going to be making $70 an hour for all of our firm's efforts. The economic incentive that's inherent in Section 1988 is what convinced us to take that case.
But the implications are breathtaking. The implications of what you're saying is that lawyers should be paid hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring trivial cases involving trivial damages, because otherwise people who inflict these trivial damages might escape legal sanction. Obviously, what you need for little wrongs, $1,000 injuries, you need some kind of alternative to, you know, constitutional litigation. You have a small claims court. You have administrative proceedings. You complain to the independent police authority review board. You don't squander $400,000 in professional services.
I got four responses to that, Your Honor. One, I don't think trivial damages equates to trivial claims, as we've said.
$1,000 in compensatory damages. That's a very small amount.
I agree it's trivial damages. I don't think it means it's a trivial claim because of the actors involved. The second point here is...
Yes, I know, but you could say it about every $1,000 damages case. Right? You spit in someone's face. That's a very ugly thing to do. But you don't get really large damages for that as a victim of such an assault. So are you saying that if you spit in someone's face, the lawyer for the victim should get $400,000 to litigate it?
No, what I'm saying is if you have a city where there's an ineffective IPRA that never punishes police, where you have a situation where the city refuses to even consider a very low offer, very beginning, and then forces a massive amount of litigation, that's the result. Look, at there's...
Well, you got $100,000 for all that.
Yeah, but we were willing to settle early on, and we put in way too many hours for that $100,000, just as an economic consideration for our firm. And that $100,000 was after there was severe cuts made, and then a totally improper 50% cut made, given the case law of both this circuit and all circuits, frankly. So that $100,000 does not entice us to bring any type of case like this in the future. And if there was a legitimate way to bring a small claim, if there was a legitimate expectation that IPRA would actually punish officers, if there was some other administrative proceeding that could be done, then that would be the proper way to go. But under the current circumstances,
has anybody complained of it about FICO? Has he been subjected to any?
Sure. There's numerous CRs. They've never been sustained.
The Independent Police Authority Board, or whatever it's called. What have they done with regard to FICO?
Nothing.
Has there been a proceeding before the board?
No, Your Honor.
A complaint to the board?
There's been not the board, to IPRA. There's been several complaints. It's not part of the record because none of them were sustained.
Not to the, what is it? Independent
Police
Authority Board or committee or what?
The police board. There's an independent police review authority, which
Review
sustains
authority.
About
okay.
one half
so,
of 1% of the complaints against police
so
officers.
Did anyone complain to the authority? We just had a case a few weeks ago where the person who police had entered or had knocked her a door down in her apartment by mistake. So she complained to IPRA, whatever you call it. So apparently people do complain to IPRA occasionally.
The number's not part of the record. There were numerous complaints, some directly, some
tangentially. Were any complaints made to IPRA about FICO?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. There were numerous complaints made about FICO by numerous people over the last several years. None of them were sustained, which is par for the course when it comes to IPRA.
Well, has anyone else sued FICO?
Yeah, there's been 11 lawsuits against FICO. There were 10 of them. This was the 10th in a four-and-a-half-year period. There were 11 lawsuits. This was the only one where punitive damages were levied. There were several settlements. There were a couple that were dismissed, and there were a couple compensatory judgments. There's one still pending. There was one that was filed after this. That's still pending.
So what was the nature of this? What were the size of the settlements? Do we know?
Yeah, I don't know off the top
of
my head.
These bigger cases than your case or littler cases in terms of harm to the plaintiff?
I would venture that they were probably mostly bigger than mine, given the damages in this case. Although, like I said, this is the only one. None of them were bigger than mine in terms of the punitive damages. None of them were bigger than mine in terms of what Officer FICO had to come out of pocket, because he never had to come out of pocket. He had never been punished by IPRA, and he never had to come out of pocket until this case. And again, when I looked on PACER this morning, since he's come out of pocket, he's never been sued.
The city paid the other settlements? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. 100% of all the other settlements were just compensatory and were paid completely by the city. In this case, the compensatory was again paid by the city. Officer FICO paid the punitive, the $1,000 in punitive. It's the only time, either by IPRA or by a jury, he's ever been personally punished. And I don't think it's coincidence that all of a sudden mm-hmm. his lawsuit stopped. Mm-hmm. I'm on the yellow, so I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schiller. Mr. DeSellis?
May it please the Court? The district court properly determined that $108,000 was the reason.
Why isn't the city doing something about FICO? There seems to be 11 lawsuits. Seems like a lot.
Well, those were just, Your Honor, first of all, those are just lawsuits. Those are just allegations.
What's the average number of lawsuits per Chicago police officer?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. I think as it pertains to the reasonable fee award in this case, the district court properly considered these the prior allegations that were made and noted that the plaintiff had never attempted to prove up any of those prior allegations or complaints in the course of the fee proceeding. And so the district court, with its discretion, reasonably did not place weight on those prior allegations. And as you just heard counsel admit.
Well, but according to your opponent, there were settlements in several of the cases against FICO.
Yeah, I was not aware of that until hearing him say that. That was not actually brought
that
to the district court's attention.
And
as you heard counsel concede, he can't show any, he admits there's no, he can't show any causation between what happened in this case and the apparent fact, which I can't corroborate either, that Mr. FICO's, or Officer FICO's behavior after the fee award in this case. Mm-hmm. So, Your Honor, the district court first calculated the lodestar by determining counsel's reasonably expended hours and their reasonable hourly rates, and then the district court reduced that amount by 50% based on Mr. Montanus's limited success in the case.
He reduced it by half based on what? I just didn't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Based on Mr. Montanus's limited success in the case, Your Honor.
Oh, limited success, right. Yeah.
We will rest on our brief with respect to the reasonably expended hours and also the determination of reasonable hourly rates and concentrate remarks on the reduction for limited success. The district court acted well within its discretion in reducing the lodestar by 50% on account of Mr. Montanus's limited success. The plaintiff's degree of success under the Hensley case is the most critical factor to determine when deciding.
Do we know why the 50% reduction was chosen?
Your Honor, the district court did provide, a few pages, a lengthy discussion of the factors it considered when determining that 50% was the appropriate reduction, including the fact that Mr. Montanus.
Well, there were a number of factors that she alluded to justify a reduction, but the 50% number seemed to be sort of ballpark, for lack of a better term. It sort of seemed to be the right number.
Yes, I don't. Under Hensley, there doesn't have to be the scientific exactitude when determining the amount to deduct for limited success. Rather, the district court has to provide a reasoned basis for doing so within its discretion, and I believe the district court did that in this case. As I was saying, the one factor that demonstrated limited success was that Mr. Montanus lost one of the two claims that he brought to trial. It's true that where the plaintiff advances multiple theories to support a single recovery and succeeds on one of those theories, that it's not proper to reduce for limited success because the plaintiff achieved all he could ask for. But in this case, Mr. Montanez's failure to intervene in excessive force claims were brought against separate defendants. And
but for the same injury, it would not have resulted in a double recovery. In other words, just joint and several liability for the same injury.
Not for compensatory damages, Your Honor, but for punitive damages. Punitive damages were, in fact, sought against both officers for different torts, I guess, one being excessive force against Officer FICO and the other failure to intervene against Officer Simon.
Okay, so it's just the punitive damages that makes it an additional claim, but not the compensatory damages, because those would compensate for the same injury and the two officers would be jointly and severally liable.
I agree with that, yes, under the facts of this case.
Why did you fight the case so fiercely? If your opponent was willing to negotiate down from $15,000, wouldn't that be? Why not say, all right, we'll give you $2,000 or something?
Well, I don't know the complete how the settlement discussions went completely, but I do believe that one major factor was the circumstances of the arrest. In other words, the plaintiff in this case had, before he brought this suit, pled guilty to aggravated battery of the police officer, which is obviously a fact that bears on his excessive force claim. In terms of also in terms of the vigorous litigation, we discussed this in our brief, but one reason that there was a for the amount of discovery in the case was that the plaintiff falsely alleged he had sustained facial fractures as a result of the arrests.
Right, but once you determine that to be a false claim, which involves getting medical records, right? Which is you can do that pretty economically. What was the point of all of the depositions of family members and friends and whatnot at the last minute and all the extensions of the discovery deadline? Why don't you just tell the judge this is a we're drawing a line in the sand here because this guy pled guilty to aggravated battery of a police officer. Let's try the case and put the three transactional witnesses on the stand and leave it at that.
I believe the family members were actually disclosed in the plaintiff's interrogatories as relevant witnesses, and that's why they were deposed. In terms of just the reasons for extensions and discovery schedules, I mean, that happens in litigation pretty routinely, depending on counsel's availability. And I know for at least some of the extensions, it was due just to counsel being unavailable due to other commitments.
What kind of case management goes on in a case like this in the district court? Does the once the magistrate judge gets it, or if the district court is sticking with the case, isn't there some sort of conference very early on in the case where the parties talk about what's needed to get the case ready for a dispositive motion or trial in the most economical way? I mean, I would think that that's what ought to happen so that we don't have cases like this where you're using $400,000 in attorney's time, not to mention whatever was spent on the public dime to have the corp counsel's office litigate this thing to death for a nuisance value recovery, which is what this was. This is a defense verdict as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
based on the level of damages. I mean, it was a plaintiff's verdict. Yeah, he prevailed and he got $2,000. But you know, I would look at that as a trial judge and say that's a defense verdict.
I'm not sure what occurred in the trial court in terms of...
Well, I'm asking ordinarily. What happens?
Ordinarily,
what
all I'm aware of, Your Honor, is just the federal rules that require a pretrial conference.
I mean, this cries out for active, vigorous, aggressive case management from the trial court to avoid this kind of expenditure of everybody's time and money, money.
I'm not sure how much of this was, you know, that the district court could have controlled, but
it's easy to do at the outset of the litigation with some assertion and effort on the part of the district court.
The second factor that supported the district court's reduction for limited success was the fact that Mr. Matamez recovered $2,000 in damages despite his initial demand of $15,000. Mr. Matamez argues it's only appropriate to compare the amount obtained to the amount sought in so-called Farrar cases where damages are de minimis. In fact, that's not the case. Farrar itself doesn't limit that consideration to damages. Does not limit that to cases of de minimis damages. And this court itself has several holdings, and we cite them in our brief, holding that it's appropriate for the district court to compare the amount sought with the amount obtained in cases where damages are greater than de minimis. And those include the Spagon v. Catholic Bishop of Chicago, Cook v. Stefani Management Services, and Conley v. National School Bus Services. Finally, in the court's discussion of whether to reduce the lodestar, it did make note of the massive disparity between the fees and the amount of damages, but that was there the court was simply following this court's instruction that the district court's fee order should evidence increased reflection before awarding attorney's fees that are large multiples of the damages recovered. And I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Schiller. Mr. DeSales?
No, the court had its full power in 26B2C3 to absolutely reduce the amount of litigation that's based on the value. The damages was clear by the time we got to the summer of 2010. Over our objections, four times discovery extensions were granted to basically depose seven witnesses who never testified. We never had an intent in calling the girlfriend, the sister, the mother, just because they happened to see his bruises a couple days later. We disclosed that they happened to see his bruises a couple days later, but why would we ever call them? That was a waste of time that the judge could have controlled at the district level. But by the time we get to the fees, then to say, well, this was too much effort and expense for such a small damage case, we didn't control that. There's no dispute that we actually put that time in.
You said in your brief that, or maybe in the oral argument, that no lawyer would handle a case like this for $70 an hour.
Sure.
These lawyers want, you know, $400, $450 an hour.
Sure.
Now, are you saying that you can't get a decent lawyer to handle a case like this for less than $450 an hour?
That's not what I'm saying.
All right. Suppose, what do you think the minimum is to get a competent lawyer to handle a case like this?
Well,
it's not a hard case, obviously. So
I think it depends on which.
But I want a number.
Well, but there's different lawyers that handle this.
I want a number.
I think it depends on who the lawyer is. If you have a lawyer that can make a lot more money,
look,
it's going to cost
I'm
money.
And no, that's you're not getting my question. A competent lawyer, what do you need to pay a competent lawyer to handle this case?
I think in this district, a bottom line competent lawyer, probably $250, $275 an hour. That doesn't have any experience and can't do anything else, but that's not the market consideration.
A competent lawyer, a lawyer competent to handle a case like this, not a brand new associate.
Okay, $250, $275.
$400 the minimum?
No, and that we don't say that's the minimum. But $400 is what at least one lawyer had already been designated at by other courts.
I understand. I mean, you can go to Sullivan Cromwell to represent you in this case. Montanez goes to Sullivan Cromwell. Sullivan Cromwell says, "Well, you know, fine with us. We charge $1,000 an hour, but you'll get really good service, and of course, the court will." Order the defendant to reimburse us. Don't you have to go to, if you want reimbursement from your opponent, don't you have to find a law firm which is competent but which is not gold-plated?
I don't think that's what Section 1988 says. But the other thing is the specific parts of this case is it wasn't complex, but it wasn't easy either to.
Well, of course not. It's an extremely weak case, and that's reflected in the damages award.
But the fact that it was won despite all of those issues, despite the fact that there was
you
so much
call it won. I don't call it won.
Your Honor, there was never any more money asked.
$2,000 for all this effort and years? No. It's a tremendous waste of resources.
I agree.
It's no one's victory.
I agree, but it was won for the plaintiff because that's all he wanted. He wanted very limited amount of money, and he wanted a judgment against the guy who beat him up, and he got it.
Why not go to small claims court for that?
Because, you don't, one, you're not going to get fees. This is somebody who obviously can't pay an attorney. And two, small claims court in Cook County becomes that it's a lot of work for a little effort, and he's not going to file it himself, and no attorney's going to represent him on it.
What's the limit on damages in small claims court?
$5,000 is the limit. And that's not why Section 1988 exists. Section 1988 exists for a reason. So we'd ask that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. DeSales.